Without taking any more of his time, I'd like to introduce you to Don M.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning, everybody. My name is Don Major, and I'm an alcoholic. And never saw so many people in my whole life. You know, the whole idea of talking up here is an experience in humility for me. And I think the way it came up is probably how my higher power is helping me get through it. Because yesterday, during Jackie's lovely talk, I had fought nature as long as I could, and finally I had to go to the bathroom. And I got up and I went, and on the way back is when I was spied by Jim and by Bernie, and they said, "We got a live one." So to realize that the only thing that I did to get up here was to need to pee has kind of got my ego a little bit in perspective. Well, I'm going to try to tell a little bit about what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now, and I am nervous. But going through anything to pay back this program, which I can never pay it back, just a little bit of what it's done for me is just something that I got to do. And if I can keep myself out of the way, I'm going to try to share with you folks and to share love with you this morning. I come from Trigg County, Kentucky, and you can't hardly tell that either. But, Jackie, wherever you are. But I was born down in southwest Kentucky on a farm between Hopkinsville and Katy's, and that was 39 years ago. And it doesn't make much difference to me how long I've been an alcoholic, because I sure am today. But I feel like that I've been an alcoholic ever since I can remember, ever since long before I took a drink, because as far back as I can remember, I didn't think normally. I knew that I wasn't like other people. At the same time, as far back as I can go in my mind, existing inside me, and I know these things sound inconsistent, but I believe most of you out there who are alcoholics will know what I'm talking about and know that it's not impossible. As far back as I could remember, at the same time I had an ego that was just monumental, that I thought that I was the most special thing that was ever brought onto this earth. And at the same time I felt like that I was absolutely nothing. And I felt like that at any time, people were going to find out that the real truth about me was that there wasn't anything at all worthwhile inside of Don Major. And I had to keep the faces on and the facades going and keep moving so fast that you couldn't draw a bead on me to find out who I really was, because if you did, you were going to find out there wasn't anything there. And that very same thought pattern still goes on today. Thanks to you people and this program and my higher power, it's a whole lot better today, and it's been getting better for about 22 months. I haven't been sober very long. But then on the other hand, that 22 months seem as big as a wagon wheel right now to me. And in a way, my whole story is the story of trying to keep moving, and trying to keep making you think that I was as great as one part of me suspected I was, without letting you know that I was as much of a nothing as I knew down in my gut that I really, really was. I left Trigg County when I was 16 and came to Louisville. I came to start the University of Louisville. And that aspect of my story has already changed at least twice or three times, because before I got to the program, I would have said that I came up here because I was just too smart, and my horizons were too broad for Trigg County, Kentucky to hold me, and I had to come to town. Then right after I got sober, my version of that would have been that I had already, through my alcoholic mind and personality and through my alcoholic drinking by the time I was 16, gotten everything in such a mess in Trigg County, Kentucky, that I had to leave. Well, neither one of those is really the fact, because I wasn't that bad at 16 years old. I'm beginning to find out now that's part of what happens to me a day at a time as I recover. I find out that I really was that thing that I feared most. I was more nearly mediocre than I could ever stand to admit. And you know, for an alcoholic, I think that's the worst thing in the world, have to face the fact that you weren't even really that bad. Because we don't want to be normal, and we're not. We get that. But what it is now is that I realize that I did have things in sort of a mess when I was 16 because of my personality, but that I felt it. Most of it was inside me, that I wanted to run. That was my first geographic change. I never thought of it that way, but that was my first geographic cure, was when I was 16, was to start college early and come on up here. Now, there is one thing that kind of lends credibility to the way I felt right after I got sober. There wasn't one thing in that county that my mother could agree with the mother of the little girls about, and that was that I shouldn't date the little girls. Now, my mother sort of had different reasoning for why I shouldn't date them than the little girls' mothers, but they did agree. Well, at any rate, I got here, and I had already started drinking. I don't know when I had my first drink. It was sometime when I was in grade school, probably at a good friend of mine's house that's still a very dear friend of mine, an earth person that can do those ridiculous things like have a couple of drinks and leave them alone. We got into his mother's blackberry cordial sometime way back in grade school, and I also found a couple of old hot cans of Budweiser out on the farm when I was a kid, and I don't know which came first. But I do know that by the time I was 12 or 13, I'd already had my first real drunk. And when I got a hold of the booze the first time, I remember that it gave me a numb, tingling feeling around my mouth, and I loved it. And it did all those things for me that we know about, and that it made it all right. That part of me that knew that there wasn't anything at all to me went away. And that part of me that knew that that's the greatest thing since sliced bread was just right there. You know, it was secure with that first drink. And, you know, I remember that feeling, or not the first drink, but the first drunk. I remember that feeling just as well today. And to some little extent, the whole 25 years of drinking that followed that, to some little extent, was trying to recapture that feeling that I remember so well from that first drunk. And I never recaptured it once. I did black out the first time that I drank much. I did throw up. I did get in trouble with my parents. So the first time that I drank more than just a little cordial or the can or two of hot beer on the farm, I began to do what alcoholics do. It was going to be, as I say, 25 years before I learned that I was doing what an alcoholic would do. I went through those 25 years thinking that practically nobody remembered anything after 9 or 10 o'clock at night. But when I got to Louisville, that kind of pulled the stops out of everything, because I did respond some little bit to my parental pressure and some little bit to the teachers and so on. My main con game when I was a kid and my main con game throughout my drinking, and if I don't watch it, my main con game right today, is that I'm going to let you think that I'm cute and I'm smart so that I can get away with doing the things that I want to do. And they were really the things that I had no control over doing. I don't know that I wanted to behave the way I did all those years. I just couldn't help it, and I came to know that I was going to. You know, I came to know that I wasn't going to be able to do what normal people did, so I'd lay a framework. I'd make good grades. I'd ingratiate myself to you, and the reason that I did that was so I'd have something in the bank that you'd let me slide when I came up and that other side of me came out that wasn't able to handle anything. So I started out making good grades at the University of Louisville where I started school, and I was drinking every night. I tell this part of my story, and it hadn't changed much. And I really, right now, think it's true. I think from the time I was 16 until the time I was 34, for that 18 years, that there wasn't 100 nights that I went to bed sober. And I don't mean went to bed without having had a drink. I mean went to bed without being pretty well drunk. And I got in trouble the end of my freshman year of college and lost my scholarship. So I went to work. Again, I thought I was going to work because just being a student wasn't enough for me. My horizons were too broad and there was just too much to hold on. Went to work for American Air Filter, and I was to work for American Air Filter out there on Central Avenue for 6 years. Got back in school, finished my undergraduate school, started law school. At age 20, I married my high school sweetheart. I won't go into the details of it, but it wasn't the day of the wedding, but about a week before the wedding, I wound up with some scratch marks on my face and my neck that were not from passion. That put me in mind of what Jackie had to say yesterday morning about one of her weddings. That unfortunate marriage lasted about 6 or 8 months with no children, and I'm sure it has some great significance in my life, but I haven't been able to find out what it is yet. I remarried while I was in law school, and by the time I graduated from law school in 68, my only child, a daughter, had been born in April of 1968, and I graduated in June of 1968. Those were the years where, even though I was drinking, I know now alcoholically, although I'll have to admit that last night Don made me stop and wonder if maybe I wasn't a social bee there for some years, but I think I better stick with alcohol. I think social bee's dangerous for this old crazy head to even think about it. But anyway, I was getting drunk every night, and I had a right successful little career at American Air Filter, but again, my drinking affected that very, very much. By the time I was going to work for American Air Filter, I was going to make a career out of it. In fact, I chose law school in a large part over getting a master's in business because the Vietnam War was going on, and I didn't want to go, and it took longer to get a law degree. But by the time I got down to my senior year of law school, my alcoholic personality and my drinking had caused the people at American Air Filter not to follow my script. And since they hadn't followed the script that I'd written for them, I decided that again I needed to broaden my horizons and go into private practice of law. And I did. I met a fellow who was a little older than I, about 15 years, who was just going into private practice because he had been with another company here in town for a long time after he had gotten out of law school. And he and I started out with, well, I had a hollow-core door over a couple of chairs, four desks, and it worked. During those years, the alcoholism apparently wasn't costing me economically or professionally. It worked very well. My practice built along mainly a criminal law lines, and his built along civil law. And we'd bring in the business, and then we'd add people, and it became a right successful little law practice. In fact, I had never thought in terms of having money. Not that I ever really had money in that standpoint, you know, from the standpoint of people who are wealthy people. But I'd come from a background that was a middle-class country background. I used to be able to tell it so you'd think I was dirt poor because we didn't have indoor plumbing, but we weren't poor. We were middle-class country farm people. And somehow, you know, I had all the grandiosity that I was going to be president of the United States. That was in there, you know, ever since I remember it. In fact, I was talking to somebody within the last 2 months, and there's somebody who knows me well in the program down in Nashville. And I just casually mentioned that I wanted to be president of the United States for the first 25 or 30 years of my life, and she was shocked. And that shocked me because I thought everybody wanted to be president, at least until they were 30. But at any rate, I never thought about having money, and having a large income came to me real suddenly when I was about 25 years old. And I think I handled it about like you would expect a 25-year-old practicing alcoholic to handle it. I went wilder than I was. Moral deterioration sort of accelerated, but I went on for 9 years doing things like divorcing and remarrying the same woman. There was one situation I remember in late 65 where the mother of my daughter and I had been divorced almost 2 years, and we were dating, you know, doing these same things that alcoholics will do, and something came up over another situation. And I remember after doing a little damage to the apartment and hitting myself and another lady, that my daughter's mama said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing," said, "you're going to hear from three people." Said, "you're going to hear from a real lawyer, the FBI, and the Internal Revenue." And I didn't want to hear from none of them. So I did the only alcoholic thing. I remarried her in 8 days. I had to shut that one up. And that hung together, such as it was, and it was a mess. By this time, my drinking was taking over. I was in a situation where we had 8 or 9 lawyers in the law firm. We'd built our own office building downtown. And as one of the two senior partners, all I really had to do was to straighten up enough to go to court every once in a while and refer people to the proper partner when they came in the door and drink. And I did, and I began to fool with drugs recreationally, but my story is an alcohol story. I am an alcoholic, folks, and drugs became very important, but to me they were just another face of my alcoholism. February 10th in 1978 is a real central time in my life, and it's interesting to me to say there are no coincidences that was 5 years ago, 3 days ago. Because February 10th of 78, I spent the afternoon down at the Fig Tree at 3rd and Broadway, which is where I spent a lot of afternoons. It was Friday. Drinking scotch and giving myself a little more chemical help in the bathroom every once in a while with a friend of mine. And I decided that I was working so hard, what I needed to do was get out of town for a long weekend. So I made reservations up in French Lick, Indiana, and then I started calling a woman to go with me. And I called either 3 or 4, including my wife. And finally, the 3rd or 4th one said, yeah, she'd go. And she was a girl that I had dated some. And I went and picked her up, and she had a little more chemical help to offset the chemical help that I'd had, so I took that, and I got the obligatory 2 bottles of vodka to go down the road with. And having reservations in French Lick, Indiana, I headed for Hopkinsville, Kentucky to see my daddy. And got quite a bit down the road, and I was driving a sports car. I got the same kind every year in the... I wanted to see how much the pollution control had slowed that particular one down, and the answer was not enough, because I went off the road at something over 130 miles an hour, and I think the young lady who was with me had a seatbelt on, because she wasn't hurt so terribly bad. She was hospitalized and had to have surgery. But I wound up being taken through the hospital in Hopkinsville, Kentucky, and them taking a look and deciding they didn't want me to die there, and send me on to Vanderbilt, and with the alcohol and other chemicals that I had in my system, they had to keep me under for about 10 hours, I think it was, to try to save my life. I had messed up both knees, lost the main artery in my lower leg, separated my pelvis, and severed my urethra. As a result of that, I spent 8 of the next 13 months in medical hospitals, and I've had either a half dozen or 7 major surgeries as a result of that accident. I lost, at least temporarily, some pretty basic bodily functions. I had what they call a suprapubic catheter through my abdomen directly into my bladder for almost a year until they took me down to Duke University and managed to get my urethra back together. Now, the fact that all this had happened had just exactly this much effect on my alcoholism. As soon as I was able to travel from Nashville, I had them pack me up. They had to replaster me practically all over my body to get me up here with all my tubes and brought me to Suburban. I got my friends in with booze and laid there in the bed and drank and laughed about the fact that this was working out great. Since I couldn't get up and walk and go to the bathroom, I had the catheter and I didn't need to. So I was that sick with the disease at that time. My daughter's mother was a little unhappy about the fact that I had the accident with the other woman in the car. In fact, I have a memory of waking up in intensive care in Vanderbilt in Nashville and sort of having an idea of what had happened and what was going on. And I remember asking if my wife was out there, and I remember a nurse or somebody saying, "I'm afraid so." And I really remember thinking that maybe not pulling through had its advantages at that time. But at any rate, I wound up going to that other woman. Now, all those years that I had drunk so heavily and had managed to hold, or it had managed to hold together economically, I never really started taking that drink in the morning. I guess like so many of us, I had that work ethic or something, and I just didn't know that I could do it. I thought I had to drag through the day that damn sick. And that accident, I think it was coming anyway. It doesn't matter because it sure got here, but I think it was progressing right on to it. But when I did start back drinking after the accident, I didn't have any control over stopping. Somebody practically had to stop me. I truly lost the choice over any drinks after the first one, and I hope to get to it in a minute that I didn't know it, but I had long since lost the choice over the first one. I married the girl who had been in the accident with me. I became addicted to the pain medicine that I was getting for the operations. In addition to my alcoholism, I did not slow down on it at all. I began to go to treatment centers. I filed my application for readmission to the Bar Association here three or four or five months ago, and I had to list the number of the ones, one of the questions, they had awful questions on that thing, like, have you ever been the defendant in a lawsuit, and have you ever been in a mental institution? And all I could put for either one of those was see attached. Have you ever been in a mental institution? I found out, and I had never really four-stepped that in that detail. I found out that I had been in a period of about a year and a half in 11 of them 18 different times. And that all began sometime in 1979, the accident having been in February 1978, and I still had braces and all sorts of things when I started my rounds of... The big book calls it somewhere the weary rounds of the asylums. And boy, that hits my whole card because that's what it was. It was the weary rounds of the asylums. The first one that I went to, by the way, I had never given much thought to the idea of a higher power except to just assume that it was superstition. And I just never considered the fact that there might be a power greater than myself that had anything to do with human affairs. I don't think I was an atheist because I had some sort of intellectual idea that there was some kind of creative force, but I certainly didn't think it had anything to do with human beings. And when they got me out of Charterton for the first time, it had just changed to Charterton from Shalimwall. They got me well enough because I got awfully sick. I'd always gotten awfully sick from drinking, and I mean physically sick. I've been through those major surgeries, and I've never had any one of them hurt me like it hurt me to sober up any of the one times I sobered up in the last few years. I'd go for major surgery over half a pint of vodka from the physical pain any time. But when they got me well enough to take me to an AA meeting, they read the steps. And when they got to the third step, I got up and said, "You mean there are people in the world who believe such crap?" And I left, and right away left treatment to go take care of my business. Well, I took care of it. My partners had to kick me out sometime in the summer of 79 of the law firm that I'd helped found. The new wife, who I'd married sometime in February of 79, were separated from me, and I was deep into the rounds of the asylums, they were repossessing fancy cars, and I was having to trade fancy watches for drugs, and remember laying for weeks in one bed out close to where my friend Max B. lives out there in the same household, drinking, best I can figure, about one of those half-gallon bottles of pop-off vodka a day. The lady who I married to died in a tragic accident in December of 79, and I can't really say that that accelerated or had much effect. That it's very, very sad to look back, because I married the lady in a blackout. I remember very, very little about it, and it's very sad to me that her gravestone bears my name, because I remember so little about that marriage. By the spring of 1980, and I made in the spring of 1980 my nicest asylum, by the way, Southland Hospital in Mobile, Alabama. It's the nicest asylum around. I spent 42 days in there, and they took me to the bus station. We had given up airplanes for that time. The money had dictated that. And I hugged my caseworker goodbye, because I'd gotten institutionalized enough that as soon as I began to get well in one of those asylums, I made myself a nest and a home. And I had my bottle of 110 milligram Valium that the shrink had given me. And I tearfully kissed her goodbye and washed her out of sight and went across the street and got two pints of vodka and drank the vodka and took the Valium, and they had to carry me off the bus when I got where I was going. So I really heard Mac W. say after I got here in Louisville that taking an alcoholic to a psychiatrist is like taking a jellyfish to an orthopedic surgeon. And I know in my case, that was absolutely true. Well, I won't get sober here before 10:45 if you can. I wound up in Nashville, Tennessee after leaving Louisville and tried to go back home to West Kentucky for a couple of months. And when I got drunk down there, it didn't take them long to figure out that they didn't want to cope with me the way I was drinking in the summer of 1980. And I wound up in a treatment center outside of Nashville, Tennessee called Cumberland Heights. That was hospitalization number 17, I know now. Spent 30 days there, and I didn't have anything to come back to. My law license had been suspended. I didn't know it then. It was suspended, by the way, because nobody paid $80 worth of dues, and I had such terrible fear of Louisville, Kentucky, that I wouldn't have opened the mail that was forwarded to me from Louisville for $100 million or to save my arms, and I'm really, really serious about it. I can't overemphasize the amount of fear and terror I had of Louisville, Kentucky. Law license was gone, and even though I didn't know that until I regained consciousness and checked on it, it didn't matter because I wasn't coming back to practice law. My body still was far from completely healed from the accident. There might have been a half dozen people who had known me for more than 30 days who wanted to speak to me, but there weren't any more than that. I didn't have a home, literally. I'm not talking about a house that I owned. I didn't have a place to go. I was looking at a halfway house down in Nashville, the First Step House. When my roommate, who was a young boy in his early 20s, whose mother was a recovering alcoholic, suggested, since I didn't have any place to go, that maybe I could come out and stay with them for a few days, and I went and stayed for 11 months. Got out of Cumberland Heights in October of 1980, and I began to go to AA meetings with some little bit of regularity, but still every time I'd hear the word God, or even worse, the term God's will, I'd have this physical thing run up my spine. It was just something I couldn't take. The spiritual aspect of the program was just too much for me. I was too smart. And I didn't stay sober between October of 1980 and April of 81. I fed myself calling myself a consultant in Nashville, which was really sort of getting people who were in business to take a little pity on me and give me a little money for this, that, or the other. Early April of 1981, I went on what, as of now, is the last drunk I've had. And I don't know, there wasn't anything really that dramatic about my bottoming, except I just really remember, this is a little rough to tell on Sunday morning, but I'm going to tell it. I was explaining to this lady that there were two kinds of men. And one kind of man had the psychology of a trick, and the other kind had the psychology of a pimp. And I wanted her to know that Don Major was at heart a real pimp. And in the next two or three minutes, she had stolen every quarter I had and swung with it. And I remember, I really do, I was in more or less a blackout, but I remember sitting there and finally thinking, Major, this ain't working. And I think that probably is where I took the first step. And then I went back to AA. I went back. This time I didn't go anywhere. I'd had a little trip to a rubber room in St. Thomas Hospital between Cumberland Heights and that day to dry out one time. I went back to AA, and God had given me a gift, which I believe is probably the greatest single gift that God has ever given me. God had made me just a little bit teachable, and God had given me a will to live. And I heard a couple of things right away that I know I'd heard before, but I really heard them this time. I heard, don't drink and go to meetings. And I did. I did pretty well what I was told right back then, and I still try to today. In the first 60 days, I went to something over 150 meetings. And I heard with regard to that spiritual part of the program that I hated so much, I heard, act as if. And I really heard it, and I started. And I had some problems with it, but it was acting as if. And I went ahead and acted. I tried not to give sway or consideration to what I was thinking or feeling. I went ahead and tried to act the way they told me to. And I remember I'd get down on my knees and I'd be praying and I'd think, well, Major, if they catch you this time, put you in the asylum again, they ain't gonna let you out because you're not drunk. And you're down here talking to this wall about something that you don't believe. But God had given me a will to live. The last few dozen times that I picked up that first drink, I didn't have any problem with my powerlessness, I don't think, or with my powerlessness over it after the first drink. I just didn't care what happened to me. But God just granted me grace, an undeserved gift from a loving God, enough caring about staying alive to try to do what the people told me. And I took my medicine, which for me turned out to be the only medicine that ever worked on what's wrong with me, alcoholism. I went to the meetings, and I began to act as if. And on the acting as if, something started happening to me. It was like when I started out, it was all acting as if and no faith. Now, the spiritual awakening that I've had, and first time I said that to anybody, I felt embarrassed about claiming a spiritual awakening and thinking I ought to qualify it and say, well, you know, if I've had one. No, I've had one. I have absolutely had spiritual awakening. And mine is definitely the educational variety that the big book talks about instead of the flash of light, because there wasn't any day when all of a sudden I believed and all of a sudden it had been shown to me. I did it 24 hours at a time like they told me that time too. And just sort of every once in a while it would dawn on me, you know, I don't disbelieve this as much as I did. And you know, the good feeling that I got was so quick. It wasn't 2 weeks into my sobriety that I really felt better than I may have ever felt in my life. Now, I was to go a long, long time in a bad material circumstance. I lived in a converted attic down there, went nearly a year without an automobile, and almost never knew 2 days from the first of the month where I was going to pay the rent on that converted attic. And I had, during the years that my disease was raging, I pretty well had whatever I wanted materially. I lived at a pretty high material level. But I was happier within 2 weeks. I think for me, my higher power just tailored this whole thing exactly, you know, for me, tailored my whole thing for Don, because I'm so damn sick that if it hadn't got that good that quick, I wouldn't have stuck with it. But it got that good before anything material even looked like it would come back. I was alienated from my only child. I had not seen her at that time since early January of 1980. I didn't know it then, but I was not to see her for a long, long time after that. I began to work on the steps. with my powerlessness, I finally got an understanding that I was powerless not only after the drinks, after the first one. It finally dawned on me that without this program and you people and my higher power, and this wasn't at first. This was one of those things that just gradually grew. It dawned on me that I'm powerless over that first drink. And that was a big difference to me. I think most people probably understand that the first time they read the step, but I was a little slow on it. I didn't. I was acting as if on the restoration to sanity and turning my life and will over, making a decision. I guess I did make a decision to do that, even though I couldn't believe beyond it. God had given me the gift of wanting to live and to understand that my way wouldn't work and that anything had to be better than my way. So I kept on trying it that way. And somewhere along the line, and it wasn't very long, those scales started tipping. And it became less acting as if and more of what in me today passes as faith in my higher power. And the term God's will, which was the one that got me the worst. I mean, that's the one that just made me want to scream and tell those people how stupid they were. The term God's will, in less than 6 months into my sobriety, had grown into the most important single thing in my life. And that is today, too. I've never gotten a glimpse of God's will for an hour from now, much less tomorrow. But I genuinely believe that if I can keep my brain, which is to a large, in a large part the enemy, and myself in general, which is the enemy, out of the way, then my God will tell me exactly the next right thing to do. Now, I get in a world of trouble because I get to want to know what he wants me to do tomorrow. Now, it seems like to me that there are a lot of times when what I need, when my next right thing is to do something that should be calculated to have a lot of effect on what happens tomorrow or maybe even next year. But that pattern still belongs to God for me. And when I start to see those patterns, it's when I get it confused and I get my brain back in it and I can obscure whatever it is in me that God will let me know the perfect next right thing to do. But if I don't obscure it, it's perfect. But he's never going to let me know but just one stitch at a time. And I got to constantly fight and keep my curiosity of wanting to see the pattern out of the way. Because the patterns are his. I began to be able to be partners with human beings. I began to be able to really and truly try to love, comfort, and understand somebody else. My self-centeredness is still... It's huge. I mean, it's a monster. I've prayed on self-centeredness in the last few hours since I found out I was going to speak up here an awful lot. But the big book tells me that we can't do much about self-centeredness on our own, that all we can do is just ask God to relieve it. And that's what I've been trying to do, is to ask God to relieve it for quite a few 24 hours now. And... you know, quite a bit. I can talk to you now, and I really can kind of be more concerned about you being loved and comforted and understood than me being loved and comforted and understood. And that's one of the many, many miracles. One of the other things that I heard when I got back to the program on April 9th of 1981 is a fellow in Nashville named Gene C. that said that he'd been sober about 11 years at that time, I think, and that he had made it his business to go around through those years to people that he knew had had a slip and ask them if on the day that they had had a drink, if that morning, if they had asked their higher power sincerely to help them not take a drink that day. And he said he had never found a single one who could say that on the day that they took the drink that they had done it. And I believe that. And if I can help it, I'm not going to start a day. I didn't start the day without asking him to help me through the day without a drink. And if I can help it, I don't plan to start tomorrow without it. I also heard that if I'd ask a day at a time for that day not to want to drink, I started out praying for this compulsion to drink to be removed, like it was a great big huge thing that was going to be removed all at once and gone and done with. and that didn't do any good. And then somebody told me, said, hey, when you pray in the morning not to drink that day, just add to it that you, you know, if it's all right with God and His will, to let you not want to drink that day. And you know that started working. And there still hadn't been any great big lifting of a compulsion as a final thing. I believe that if I were to start being dishonest and let my life become unmanageable again, that compulsion and insanity would come back on me, because I'm a sickie. I'm a real sick one, believe me. That it would come back on me, and that I'd have the compulsion, and if I get the compulsion, I'm going to drink in a very short period of time. But I found out that just on a day-to-day basis, that if I ask God for that day, if it's His will for me not to want to drink, that it's been a lot of days in a row since I've wanted to drink. I've begun to know a little bit that I'm not the center of the universe. I'm just a baby in that, and God is just revealing to me a little bit at a time and letting me just begin to become a real partner with all of you all and understand that I'm just a little piece of all this wonderful, wonderful fellowship and this wonderful universe. I'm going to tell about coming back to Louisville, and then I'm going to close, because I did not want to come back to Louisville. I'd been sober while in Nashville, and I'd been able to live completely with recovering people. There's a couple of them up here from Nashville right now, Jim and Elaine over there, that were mighty close to me. As I said, for the first 11 months that I was out of the treatment center, the first 5 months I was sober, I literally lived in the house with recovering people. When I began to go into business, the people that I worked with in business were AA members. When I dated, the women that I dated were pretty well AA members. My social life was to go to AA meetings. In the last 22 months, it's been something more than an average of one a day. I don't know how many, but it's averaged more than one a day. I didn't have any identity in Nashville, Tennessee, much, except that as a recovering alcoholic. And I had an identity in Louisville, Kentucky, other than a recovering alcoholic. And I'd sat down there and tried to begin to work at the 8th and 9th steps, and I'd written some letters up here, and I'd made some phone calls, and I'd even seen a couple of people face-to-face on making amends to people in Louisville. But I was doing it with an insulation. I was told a time or two that what I was doing all right was all right, but I had my head in the sand. But I thought, well, I guess I'm just going to have to keep this head in the sand, because I'm staying sober, and I'm going on, and I'm doing fine. Well, in the late summer of this last year, of 82, I had begun to be able to make a little living down in Nashville. I kept on doing the same things I had been doing, but the doors started closing. I wasn't able to make a living anymore. The last 3 months that I worked down there, I grossed something like $300 or $350. My law license got reinstated up here in November. When I came back to make amends to my two primary old former partners for what I'd cost them and what I'd done to them here in Louisville, my reception was such that they offered to help me financially go back into practice in Louisville. So every time I made a move toward Louisville, the doors fell open. And every time I made a move toward staying in Nashville, my higher power in His gentle and loving way said, oh, you can do whatever you want to, son. You can stay in Nashville, because you're fixing to starve to death. But He always gives me a choice. It's just that He kind of loads the choices. I've got a choice of taking a drink today, too, but the alternative of taking one isn't very attractive. Well, I came up here. I started on December the 30th to come to back to Louisville. And I didn't have an automobile. My former partners had had to arrange for an old car, and I loaded all my earthly possessions except my Tomcat and had to give him away into that car, and I headed up I-65 to come to Louisville to go into law practice again. I got 30 miles north of Nashville, and the universal joint and the transmission fell out of it. Well, God gave me the serenity, because I just thought, well, I know it's God's will for me to go to Louisville, but it must not be His will for me to get up there today. And I walked to an exit and waited 6 days until I got another car, and I came to Louisville. I went to the Token Club before I went to where I was going to spend the night that night. And saw, remember seeing Mike E. over there and a few people. And I had been to one or two meetings up here in the few weeks before I moved up and seen Larry. Now, I knew that Max B. was in the program because when I was at Our Lady of Peace one time, I woke up out there real sick. It was about the second or third day, and I had a real good grasp on where I was, and the Thorazine and stuff wasn't really doing a thing for the real hangover and withdrawal. And I saw an old boy that I used to represent that was out there doing some remodeling work, so I sent him out for a pint of vodka. And he got it and brought it back, and I had drunk it. You know, they can't smell vodka. And they were having an AA meeting out at Our Lady of Peace, and I looked up, and there was old Max. Now, I knew Max because he and I used to drink down at Third and Liberty together years ago. In fact, I always said that if I got as bad as Max, I was fixing to quit. And we didn't know what had happened to Max. It was almost 11 years ago, between 10 and 11 years ago. Some of us thought he had died or something, and I know now that he had joined AA. But Max was out there going to speak to the patients at Our Lady of Peace, and I'd already had my pint of vodka, so I was feeling fine. I thought, well, this is great. I'll get to talk to old Max. And just as we were all getting lined up for the meeting and everything, the nurse stuck her head in and said, Mr. Major, can we draw some blood on you? They, of course, smelled that vodka, and I let them take the blood test and knew where I was going to come back, so I just, they didn't have me locked up at that time. I just kept on walking, got a cab, and finished getting drunk. But that, too, was perfectly right from my God because I knew that Max was in AA up here. And in coming back to Louisville, I called Max. And on the first day that I got back, I talked to him and I asked him, and he accepted to be my transition sponsor. Because that's another thing that I had done like they told me to do. I got a sponsor that time in April 1981 right away. And I started calling that sponsor and I started listening to that sponsor. And Max introduced me around, and I came up here with more fear than you people can possibly imagine. I sat at Elaine Jim's table and bawled like a baby out of fear of coming back up here to face everybody. In the one or two meetings I'd been up here, AA seemed strange and foreign and hostile to me, and I thought AA up here wasn't going to be like it was in Nashville. And I just knew that all these people that I'd wronged and that I was embarrassed in front of because of my alcoholism, that it was going to be awful. And the legal community, I knew that they were, you know, probably never going to accept me. Well, AA took me right in. It's been so, so beautiful. Max showed me around, and other people started showing me around and introducing me. It wasn't a week until I was really thinking in the back of my mind, you know, I believe AA up here is better than it was in Nashville. And the legal community, a day at a time, has been accepting me back just wonderfully and wonderfully. My former wife, my daughter's mother, came down to my office to see me when I'd been in town about a week or 10 days, and she sat and talked to me about an hour, and she doesn't know what you saw in me, but I do. What you saw in me was you and my higher power in this program. But she saw something in me that she liked well enough. There were a lot of good reasons not to let me see my daughter now or ever. She saw something in me she liked well enough that within about 2 weeks of the time I got up here, I had a date with my daughter. I've had several with her. Through this program and my higher power, I was able to sit in my law office in Louisville, Kentucky. First, I knew I could never come back to Louisville. Second, I knew I could never practice law. With the daughter that I had had to give up ever seeing, telling me how she was going to decorate my law office. And if any of you don't think that this program works, not just on drinking, but on everything that's wrong with an alcoholic, take my word that it works on what's wrong with this alcoholic, a day at a time, as long as I'll let it. But another thing, when I got back up here, I want to add this because it's been so important to me. Somewhere about a year ago, one of the people in the program in Nashville put me on to regularly reading the 11th step in the big book about upon awakening every morning and doing an inventory on the before we retire every night. that was one of the huge things that began to change my life. That's when the real joy, you know, already 2 weeks sober, was feeling better than I ever had in my life. But when I was able to start doing some of those 10th and 11th step things is when some real joy started to come into my life. When I thought meditating was what monks did. And I found out it's the most practical thing in the world. They got simple instructions right there on page 86. I'd sit there in the morning with a cup of coffee and dip a snuff in my mouth and make a list of what I needed to do that day. And then when I got up here, my fear level was so great that I got a little deeper into that 11th step and realized that it said for me to say humbly and real frequently to myself, "Thy will be done." And I realized that it didn't say for me to just say that when things were going real good, or for me to just say that when things were going real bad. It said for me to just say that. So I started doing that, and that has made a huge difference. And it told me to remind myself constantly that I'm no longer running the show. And believe me, this morning is a great example of that, because I'm not capable of getting up here only 22 months sober and talking to you folks, because I wasn't capable of making this talk, so I had to keep reminding myself that all I did was have to pee. But the beauty and the wonder of being sober, and one more thing, that I think it's the 12 and 12 talks about, that we weren't the kind of people that wanted any of the values or promises that this program's got to offer. And it was only under the lash of alcoholism that we were driven to it. And that's absolutely true of me. And I'm sorry to the core for everybody who was hurt because of my alcoholism and my insane behavior. But from my standpoint, I know that it was just right. And I'm grateful for every bit of it. I'm grateful for every injury. I'm grateful for every loss. I'm grateful for everything that happened, because it took all of that to give me enough teachability to be here and to get down on my knees and to ask God to help me and to ask God to reveal himself to me, which he is doing a day at a time. Until if I'd gone on and hadn't bottomed the way I had, I guess I would have finished living, if that's what I was doing, and died, believing that the object of life was to keep everything juggled and in the air until you die. That was the way to win. And that's really what I believed. I believed that was a winner in life, was somebody whose house of cards didn't fall in on them before they died. Well, I lost. I didn't die first, and the house of cards fell in. And I'm sure grateful. And this has been wonderful. I hope I've said something to help somebody, and I love every one of you. Thank you.